Welcome to the first live stream recording of the Archaeology of the World podcast. I'm Dr. Ali H. Akhtar. You can follow the show on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram by searching the hashtag Archaeology of the World. You can also listen along on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Prof. Ali Akhtar, P-R-O-F-A-L-I. A-K-H-T-A-R. I want to jump right into the question of why archaeology is so important in history and why it's still a field of study, why people still study it in grad school, and why the whole image of Indiana Jones is actually pretty prevalent around the world amongst European, Middle Eastern, Asian, African archaeologists, some of whom we know about because they're kind of influencers on Instagram and elsewhere, and a lot of whom we don't know as much about, because I think at the end of the day, they're not necessarily creating a lot of public intellectual content. The days of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, the heyday of kind of public archaeology, public intellectuals like Indiana Jones, might be long gone, but they're kind of coming back through things like Instagram. There was this one guy, I think it was maybe Gino Caspari, some Italian archaeologist who is definitely kind of jumping right back into that public archaeologist, public intellectual world that I thought was interesting, with a lot of followers. And his followers kind of showed that the interest is still there. So Indiana Jones is probably a good place to start. The question of why that image of an archaeologist is so fixated in the imaginations and fascinations of people all around the world back in the 1980s and 90s when those movies were around. Indiana Jones is someone who, in those movies, his work takes him to places like the Middle East and India. And these are two of the traditional places where a lot of the most famous American and European archaeologists made their names. Here's a FedEx truck passing by me. Never mind the noise. Suburban sounds. So, why Egypt and India? Well, these are two of the central regions where the British Empire was very active back in the 17, 18, and 1900s. Egypt was previously ruled by the Ottoman Empire. It was captured by the Ottomans in the 1500s from an earlier group, the Mamluks, and the Ottomans subsumed Egypt into Ottoman dominion, governing Cairo and Alexandria from the Ottoman capital in Istanbul. And that went on from the 1500s into the 1800s. And by the 1800s, an independent dynasty of Ottoman military officers under the founding, the founder of that dynasty was the famous Muhammad Ali, or in Turkish, Mehmet Ali. He was born in what is now around Greece and Albania, Southern Europe, and he founded the dynasty. The dynasty basically became an independent, ruled over a semi-independent Egyptian kingdom. So they were semi-independent of the Ottomans in the same way that the Tunisian rulers, the Beys, were also semi-independent of the Ottomans. And as part of that semi-independence, the British managed to, and the French managed to, move in a kind of power rivalry of the 1800s, and they met around the Mediterranean Sea, where the French and British armies were becoming increasingly powerful. The British, because so much of their activities were all around the world, relied on advanced shipping and military technology, and just like the Dutch before them, the 1600s. And likewise for the French, they also had this incredibly powerful land-based army under Napoleon in the late 1700s. So by the end of it, places like Egypt did not succumb to direct British rule in the 1800s. The longer history, the trend was more a kind of semi-independent rule, where the British had a lot of control over the politics of the region and whatnot. And so the outcome of that was that, as part of the governance, indirect political influence over places like Egypt, and as part of the more direct political influence over places like India, the British assembled a team of experts who began to now study the cultures more deeply than they had already done previously. and partly for the sake of governance, and also partly from the more or less as part of the entire spectrum of knowledge that was required for British and French governance of regions that they colonized. Now, it's not as though they first took an interest in the languages and cultures of places like the Middle East and Africa and Asia just for the sake of colonization. We know that way back in the days of the Renaissance, other European powers, including the French, but more so a lot of the Italian republics, were already, as far back as the 10 and 1100s, the Spaniards likewise, were already taking a lot of interest in Middle Eastern languages and learning the Arabic corpus of Arabic medical writings in the 9, 10, 1100s incorporated a lot of the translations from Greek into Aramaic and Arabic translations from back in the 7 and 800s of the Common Era, so after the time of Jesus. The Arabic Arabic and Arabic surgery, Arabic medicine was so sophisticated. Arabic pharmaceutical pharmacology was so sophisticated that the writers in Latin by the 11, 12, 1300s in places like Spain and Sicily, Norman Catholic Sicily, began to now have a lot of that work, cartography, medicine, pharmacology, translated into Latin. So there's already an early interest there, and that continued in places like Paris. But with the kind of age of exploration and the early forays of the Spaniards and the Portuguese into the Americas on the way to Asia, and the Portuguese crossing the southern tip of Africa to Iran and India over to China, with the 16, 1700s, you began to see more of what we think of as modern semi-colonial activities. Semi-colonial because in some cases, the Portuguese in places like Macau, next to Hong Kong, were negotiating for settlement privileges. The Portuguese were also participating in a kind of inter-Asian trade. They were seen in some cases as kind of like European pirates in Asia by Asian powers. And in some cases, partners of trade. They would buy things in Southeast Asia, sell them in Iran. But there was a semi-colonial element because in some places, the Portuguese in the 1500s and the Dutch after them in the 1600s and the British began to actually just outright conquer lands militarily. This included the Sultanate, the Sultans of Malacca in Malaysia, which was originally back in the 1400s, a kind of vassal state where their patron was the Ming Dynasty of China. So Malaysia was the back door of China, and there was also coastal India, a lot of kingdoms there. The Portuguese in the 1500s began to conquer a lot of those coastal kingdoms, and the Dutch likewise did the same thing in Indonesia. And so you began to see now more of the kind of early colonial era activities of these European powers, and this is where, on the one hand, the kind of study of the cultures and the languages and the ecology of the region, a lot of that for under the Portuguese and the Spaniards eras of Asia, when the Spaniards captured the Philippines in the 1500s, when the Portuguese were settling in Macau. Back in those days, you'd have a little bit more of a kind of philosophical, scientific inquiry into the study of the world, with some applications related to, pharmaceuticals. So the Jesuits, a Catholic group, were heavily involved in Asia as kind of in the 1500s as diplomats, but also as scientists, theologians, and their activities were multidimensional under the patronage of the Portuguese and the Spaniards. So they were studying cartography. They were developing works of cartography, botany, all kinds of things in Asia, in collaboration with a lot of Chinese and Japanese scientists. And there was, among other dimensions of that activity, there were some proselytizing, evangelizing activities there, where they also were interested in kind of bringing Christianity, Catholicism, over to Asia, which they did. People like Matteo Ricci. But still, there wasn't also a kind of simultaneous learning for learning's sake, science for science's sake, and also science for the applications of science's sake, interest in cartography, astronomy, pharmaceuticals, in the legacy, in the spirit of the older and even contemporary at the same time, Arabic and Persian and Turkish language writers who, in the 1500s were also building, what do you call those things? Astronomers, they have those observatories. They were building observatories. The Persian and Turkish speakers were building observatories in places like Uzbekistan, a little bit east of Iran, but west of China. A lot of those astronomers ended up in Istanbul with the rise of the Ottoman Empire. So you had this Asian, multidimensional scientific world of learning, and the Jesuits participated in transmitting a lot of that to westward, and then also bringing their own traditions of science over to the east, this era of exchange. And so there is this kind of pre-colonial, more or less, history of cultural and scientific learning and dialogue. But as you get into the colonial era, this is where there are particular applications of a lot of these scientific inquiries and studies of the local cultures and studies of the local ecosystem that have a specifically colonial application. And so one is the example of how the Dutch and the British began to now think about ways of colonizing the Dutch in Indonesia, when they began to, in the 1600s, recognize that there was this increasing and global market for Middle Eastern, East African coffee, and also Middle Eastern and East African coffee, and also Chinese tea. So Europeans, in their interactions with the Middle East and in their interactions with China, they began to consume tea. The Portuguese were amongst the earliest European consumers of Chinese tea, and in the 1500s, later after them the Dutch, and then later the English, and then the Italians were amongst the earliest consumers of Middle Eastern and East African coffee in the 1400s and 1500s. And so the outcome was that the Dutch began to say, well, we've now actually managed to capture significant chunks of Indonesia. Why don't we bring coffee from East Africa and the Middle East over to Indonesia? And this is where you get Sumatra coffee. And so this is where now the study, learning how to actually cultivate coffee and grow coffee and bring the beans over to Sumatra and actually grow Sumatra coffee, does require a sophisticated understanding of botany, agricultural sciences. And this is where now you can begin to see how there's a specific kind of colonial an economic dimension to a lot of the study of, in this case, not only the local ecosystem and the local environment, but also the local climate, but also the local cultures, understanding the difference between the kind of rural dimensions of Indonesia versus the urban dimensions. Are there farmers already there who can do this work? And this is where, you know, the Portuguese were, the Dutch were doing this in Indonesia. The Spaniards at the same time, a little bit earlier, back in the 1500s, were doing the same thing in the Americas after conquering the Incan, Mayan, and Aztec empires. They also had an interest in cultivating gold and mining gold and silver, and also cultivating a lot of agricultural products. And so there was the question there of, well, who is going to do that work? And so this is where these Spaniards, in particular, in contrast to the Portuguese relied heavily on West African slaves on their sugar plantations, on the Portuguese sugar plantations in Brazil. The Spaniards relied heavily on the indigenous peoples, and specifically the kind of older agricultural tradition, and basically kind of repurposing that indigenous labor for Spanish colonial pursuits, and including mining, where in fact we know that a lot of the West African slaves whom the Spanish brought over to Mexico were in fact brought to the cities. And so this is where there's an interesting story there. There's some books on this, how the Spaniards at some point, in contrast to the Portuguese, stopped bringing West African slaves for a variety of reasons related to the politics of Europe and West Africa. And a lot of those West African slaves who had become Catholic by the 1600s, in fact, became very historically intertwined in the cities with the older European white communities. And this is where the Spaniards began to use a lot of terms that are now, back then and now, seen as kind of exclusionary and racist, in many contexts. So this is where they began to talk about mulattoes, people who are of mixed white and black heritage. And this is where a lot of the research is actually showing that by the 1800s, as the as Mexico became independent, a lot of these urban kind of mixed heritage white and black heritage peoples, or European and African heritage peoples, many of them appear to have kind of just identified as part of that new national identity of Spanish mestizaje, mestizos, so kind of mixed heritage European indigenous peoples, even if they actually were of African descent. So kind of interesting. So this is where the Dutch likewise are now studying the kind of culture and the labor of Indonesia to figure out how to maximize their colonial output of the economy there. This is where, you know, you fast forward to the modern world, this is where a lot of these governments ended up nationalizing a lot of the industries and expelling not only colonial powers in the 1900s, but also expelling a lot of foreign companies. And you see a kind of official turn in many cases towards socialism and very large big government control and construction of industries because of that. As a, you might look at that as a kind of reaction to several hundred years of colonial presence that expanded a lot of the local agriculture in order to kind of extract resources out of the labor and the land. And also the fact that it actually is a lot of private companies that are semi-private because they are closely connected with the colonial governments. It is in fact several semi-private companies that are doing a lot of this work, colonial work. So it's the Dutch government, but it's really more the Dutch East India Company. And likewise in Brazil, the Dutch West India Company back in the 1700s, 1800s. And likewise for the British, it's the British East India Company. And this is where some British now look back and say, oh, we should not let private companies have so much control of the government. This is where other observers will say, well, come on, how private were these companies when they were basically doing the work of the colonial government? And in fact, they were given in terms of how these private companies competed with one another. These private British companies competed with one another for government contracts and government kind of charters and subsidies, the equivalent of subsidies. In fact, these companies were actually given a monopoly for different, the trade of certain goods. So the British gave the British East India Company, the British government gave the British East India Company a monopoly to the exclusion of other British companies for the trade of things like Chinese tea. And this is where the whole idea behind the British East India Company trying to figure out ways to capture the lands of South Asia, either through projects that would put the local rulers in debt, and then using the British East India Company's own private military forces to then take over, or just taking over outright, that a lot of that activity was in fact related to interests of the British East India Company in having more direct access to the ports of South Asia, where from there they could control not only things like the narcotics opium trade, but also the tea trade. And in fact, the British could then begin to expand the cultivation and growth of tea in India once the British East India Company realized that, in fact, the secrets to Chinese tea cultivation could actually be transferred over to India in the 1800s by bringing in Chinese specialists, kind of intellectual property transfer in the language of modern science and technology. So the outcome of all that is that this is what you're seeing. The British in India in the 1800s and the Dutch before them in Indonesia really developing a very sophisticated understanding of the land and agriculture and ecosystem and also labor culture of these regions that they conquered, because there's an interest in extracting, again, a lot of the resources and capturing a lot of the trade routes and likewise growing certain cash crops on the land. Tea in India, for the French and what they called Indochine, Indochina, what is now Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. For the French, it was all about rubber in Vietnam. And the outcome is that this is where you begin to see in the 1700s, 1800s that this kind of older inquiry of learning Middle Eastern and Asian sciences for the sake of, you know, advancing European infrastructural technology and advancing European medicine. So the the idea, that older idea of the Spaniards and the Norman Sicilians, those Norman adventurers, French-speaking adventurers who captured southern Italy, who were Catholic in the 10-1100s from the Muslim Emirate, which had captured Sicily a few hundred years after the fall of the Western Roman Empire in the 400s, and the Eastern Roman Empire, the surviving eastern half, captured certain parts of Italy. The German powers captured other parts of Italy, but by the 800s, the rising Muslim powers had captured Sicily, and by the 1000s, the Norman Catholic French conquerors had captured Sicily from the Muslims. And so that's the famous story of the Normans who were hiring a lot of Arabic-speaking cartographers and scientists, in the same way that the Castilian Catholic rulers of the 10-1100s, people like Frederick II in Sicily, people like Alfonso el Sabio, Alfonso the Wise in Castile, in Toledo. This is where there's that whole older story of transferring a lot of this Arabic learning for the sake of advancing European varieties of medicine and infrastructure and engineering and whatnot. But here in the 1700s, 1800s, it's also the idea additionally of studying the local culture and studying local ecosystem and whatnot in order to actually advance a little bit more of a kind of private company's colonial project, with the kind of support and patronage of the Dutch Republic, and with the support and patronage of the British Crown in the 1700s and 1800s. And so it's from there where you can see how you begin to see now the 1800s, 1900s, you begin to see how new varieties of European industrialization. At this point, European powers like the British and the Dutch are now becoming very sophisticated in the development of weapons and firearms. Even though gunpowder originally comes from China, there's a degree of advancement in the development of firearms on the European side, in parallel with the development of shipping technology. As much as a lot of the most powerful, famous, largest ships of the medieval and ancient world came from China, gunpowder comes from China. By the 1700s, 1800s, the Europeans are so advanced, the Dutch and the British especially, are so advanced in their activities, traveling around the world, crossing, traversing the lake, giant seas of the oceans of the Atlantic and the Pacific. The Spaniards by the 1600s have figured out how to have a kind of back and forth trade route between Acapulco and Mexico and Manila and the Philippines, crossing back and forth in the Pacific, learning how to, with unprecedented degrees of accuracy, being able to traverse the open seas with no sense of where the coast is at this point, because they're just completely open oceans. That degree of sophistication in navigation and shipping technology, and also in shipping technology, including high-walled boats, the famous cogs, carracks, Portuguese carracks, that are so high in their walls that they can withstand choppy waters, and they can also form strong defense against any kind of firearms or cannons that were being mounted on these boats at the time in the 1500s, 1600s. There's so much sophistication there, including in the firearms, that by the 1800s, 1900s, all this kind of all this European experimentation has now allowed the Europeans, whose interest in traveling around Asia was partly inspired by the lack of resources and manufactured goods coming out of Europe, where all the porcelain and the tea and the originally the paper is coming out of China, and the spices are coming out of Indonesia, and a lot of the sophisticated textiles are coming out of the Middle East, and coffee in Europe, coffee in the Middle East and whatnot. That desire since the 1500s to now begin manufacturing their own things becomes, for military purposes, for just creating kind of new artificial versions of these Chinese commodities. So by the 1600s, 1700s, learning how to emulate the Middle Eastern peoples, who have potters who had created a kind of pseudo porcelain with earthenware, clay, and learning how to put all kinds of, like in an art class, a slip over their own pottery to make it look like porcelain, experimenting with things like crushed glass, as was previously done in the Middle East back in the 800s-900s, learning how to make artificial porcelain, and learning how to make, you know, tea tasting drinks and whatnot. All of that innovation by the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s leads the peoples of Northern Europe to begin now developing sophisticated industrial technology, factories, coal, steam technology, moving raw materials from one place to another very quickly, mass producing things, learning how in factories to divide labor and come up with basically mass produced versions of things that people want from Asia. So they, you know, in the in places like Delft in the Netherlands, creating what is now the famous Dutch tile work, which looks like porcelain but actually isn't porcelain, learning in England how to create English versions of porcelain, Staffordshire ware. And by the end of it, the it's the interest in now bringing some of that industrial technology over to the colonized regions or the semi-colonized British regions for the sake of growing and increasing the output of a lot of what the Europeans were trying to grow in Asia, where whether it's the factories for cotton in Egypt, where the British are now interested in expanding the Egypt previously in the 1700s-1800s, an exporter of a lot of finished textiles, learning how to do what they were doing in India, expand the production of cotton with factories in Egypt using Egyptian farming labor, which again leads into the situation in the 1950s where the government becomes officially socialist in the name of farmers, where by the 1980s and 90s there's a turn away from that socialism because there's a sense that, well, the farmers didn't come out ahead as planned, or at least to the degree that was planned. So the outcome is that the British are now bringing, and the Dutch are bringing a lot of these modern 1800s, 1900s technological advancements over to Asia. And this is where now there's this colonial interest in basically modernizing parts of Asia. And this is where, and this is where there's a study of the cultures there, and you have this whole kind of these teams of specialists who are studying the culture, studying the law there, where this is where the British are famously trying to now rely on a mix, kind of a hybrid mix of local laws of the Indian kingdoms, including varieties of Islamic jurisprudence, and mixing some of those customs with British law. And the outcome is that the British by the 1800s, like the French in North Africa, like the Dutch in Indonesia, they embark on this kind of modernizing mission, which from the from European perspectives is something that European powers today will say, well, you know, shouldn't these Asian countries thank us for having helped usher in the modern age with all these new factories? This is where a lot of those powers, you can see, like, you know, Singaporean leaders, Lee Kuan Yew, the late Lee Kuan Yew, would probably point out that as much as they may have admired and certainly admired a lot of British conceptions of modernization and industrialization, that there was a sense from Asian perspectives and Middle Eastern perspectives that a lot of this modernization in the middle, industrial modernization in the Middle East and Asia in the 1800s was not being done for the sake of the local peoples. And this is where you began to see people like Lee Kuan Yew saying in the 1960s and 70s, well, how about, you know, how about the people who are left out of this modernization process under in British Malaysia, specifically, you know, the farmers of Malaysia, or likewise who are, you know, who are manufacturing rubber for the British, or likewise the Singaporean peoples who load rubber onto the docks, who are living in shanty towns. And so this is where you begin to see now a lot of these modern leaders in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s beginning to say, well, maybe the people who are at the lowest economic rung of society, maybe they should have a kind of a share of this modern, the output of all this modern industrial modern industrialization. This is where you'll see people like Nasser in Egypt in the 1950s saying, we need to help the farmers and they come to power partly with through that appeal, or Lee Kuan Yew in the 70s and 80s saying, we need to help these people who are now living in these shanty towns and modernize Singaporean industrial, modernize Singaporean housing, in Malaysia likewise, this move towards moving people from the rural regions to the cities. And so the outcome of all that is that through from the European side of all this, back in the 17, 18, 1900s, that whole modernizing, industrializing mission, as much as these Asian and Middle Eastern powers and later reformers saw it as actually enriching the European colonizers and not enriching like the farmers and the people in Singapore who were loading things onto the docks. This is where on the European side of that mission, there was these experts who not only were studying the agricultural ecosystems of the region, but they were also studying the cultures of the regions. And this is where you begin to see now, as a kind of offshoot of that European 17, 18, 1900s industry of, I don't want to call it industry of experts, but where you see amongst those experts, you see people who are delving very deeply into the history of the laws and the legal systems and the social customs. The British are going to now synthesize older forms of legal customs and maybe the older and more decentralized legal customs of the kingdoms of South Asia, including the Mughal Empire and its Islamic jurisprudence that also left a lot of room for non-Islamic local governance in a population that was also mixed with different religions, Buddhists and Hindus and whatnot. This is where the British are now studying the history of the law of the regions. They want to know everything about the cultures of the regions, all of the languages, Arabic, Persian, Sanskrit, Turkish, likewise with the Ottoman Empire. A lot of this is happening partly people are not kind of just watching this with no power or agency. A lot of historians would argue that certainly a lot of the ruling circles of Egypt and the Middle East and Southeast Asia, in the same way that the Japanese in the 1800s said, we have to kind of just adopt these European ways or we're going to get conquered. You do see a lot of these Middle Eastern and North African powers, the Muhammad Ali dynasty in the 1800s, they were known as the, in Turkish, the Huduv, or in Arabic, the Khadiwi, the Khadiv. They were very much kind of competing with each other to advance and modernize their industries to resemble more of these European industries. So they're kind of participating in this process. This is where, later observers in the 1900s would say that they would argue, well, didn't a lot of these leaders become too much in the pocket of the British and the French, to the exclusion of the farmers? Other observers would say, sure, but maybe they needed to have more time for this whole industrialization process to actually trickle down to the farmers. All these debates about that. But the outcome is that by the 1800s, in continuity with that really much older tradition of studying Middle Eastern and Asian cultures, you have this very sophisticated European industry of producing experts. And I make it sound bad, but it's kind of what it was. It was a sort of industry of experts who, many of whom are kind of active participants in some kind of colonial administration, but on the less negative side, maybe a lot of them are just not active participants in the colonial administration. Whether they are or not, you just have a lot of interesting, curious minds amongst these experts who are now getting very interested in ancient Egypt and ancient Iran, and they want to know, what makes the Iranian cultures of the Qajar dynasty in the 1800s, what makes it so unique and different from the Turkish cultures of the Ottomans and the Armenian Orthodox Christian cultures that are both in the Ottoman Empire and the Iranian Empire, Jewish history. And so you begin to see the story of, individual people like the historians and archaeologists who discover, for example, in a synagogue in Cairo, the famous Cairo Geniza collection a collection of documents written by Arabic-speaking Jewish merchants from almost 1,000 years ago, whose writings and receipts and documents were all preserved and stored in a storeroom in a particular Cairo synagogue. And it was discovered much like the way an archaeologist would discover like a sarcophagus of a pharaoh. These historians and archaeologists and philologists, kind of a fancy word for linguists, they are discovering in the 1800s these old treasure trove of documents written by Jewish merchants from 1,000 years ago. And you begin to see now that they engage in a kind of translation. They develop their translation activities, learning how to decipher. You know, they discover very quickly that in fact this is the documents are written in Arabic with Hebrew script. So very easy to decipher. And they learn from those documents the stories of, in the 10, 11, 1200s, all of these kind of Jewish merchants from Cairo who are active in Norman Sicily with some particular Arabic-speaking merchant who may have been Muslim, may have been Jewish. And you get to see through these kinds of documents the fact that in the medieval world there was a kind of medieval economy and medieval cultural exchange, where places like Italy were in fact long before the Italian kingdom of the late 1800s, long before the Italian Empire, the 1900s, in the days of the divided republics, which themselves were maritime empires like the Republic of Genoa, the Republic of Venice in the 10-1100s, the historians at the time began to realize that, wow, these cultures and empires were actually very closely intertwined. Ruling circles in Egypt and Turkey and Italy at the time knew each other, lived amongst each other, and spoke each other's languages. Ottoman sultans who spoke Italian, who in some cases were of Italian descent. Jewish merchants from the 1500s who spoke Spanish, who lived in Italy and Egypt and Turkey, who spoke Arabic and Turkish as well. And within that whole industry of, I guess we can call it an industry, it's like an academic industry, of learning and studying the past and learning the cultures of the past, the laws of the past, you begin to see people who now go as far back as digging for remains of the civilizations of the ancient world. All these people come to be known as, in many European centers, as Orientalists, because they study the Orient. And Orientalism in the 17, 18, 1900s is the word that is used to identify people who study these parts of Asia from different perspectives. So you get the archaeologists who are Orientalists, or students of the Orient, specialists of the Orient, what was called the Orient at the time, basically Africa, the Middle East, Asia. You have historians who are Orientalists, or so Orientalist historians, Orientalist archaeologists. You have artists who are, you know, traveling to these parts of the world to find new ways of depicting these regions and telling the story of these regions, Orientalist artists. Their paintings are very famously still circulating in prints quite widely, and there are a lot of, they're the subject of controversy to some extent because of the ways that the artists kind of embellished their representation of Asia, in some cases really using a lot of their own fantasy to depict these places both as very wealthy and exotic, like in the Aladdin movie, but then there are some kind of darker representations there. It may be very, these places are being, as being places with kind of no rule of law, or places that are considered very violent. So you'll see that even in the Aladdin movie, the famous scene that where there's some kind of capital corporal punishment for someone who wants to someone who is poor, who wants to steal some food to eat. So the archaeologists, particularly the archaeologists of the Middle East and Asia, they are not all coming out of this, not even most, but a big section of that history comes out of this European investigation and study of Asia and the Middle East and Africa. And so this is where you begin to see, you know, the extraction from the ground of the sarcophagi of the ancient pharaohs in southern Egypt. And this is where, if you look at these black and white photos of these archaeologists back in the 1800s, a lot of them are British people and Dutch people, because, you know, you have to be paid for a lot of this stuff. And the British government and the Dutch government, and also private investors, and also just very wealthy inheritors of businesses, people who come from these families, are participating in these activities. And it can be very personally fulfilling and kind of a very interesting and intellectual journey, a life of the mind, but it can also be part of a career that allows one to work for the administrative governments. And it can also be part of a career of someone who wants to now work alongside art sellers and art dealers, where this is where you begin to see some of the most controversial sides of a lot of this, where people begin to now buy and sell a lot of the antiquities. So this is the controversial continuing modern sale of antiquities. Buying and selling antiquities from Iraq, ancient Iraq, ancient Iran, and selling those to different dealers, and then those private dealers eventually selling it or gifting it to museums. And this is the whole controversy over archaeological objects that are sitting in British and Dutch museums. So they end up sitting in a lot of the countries that were the countries associated with colonization. So that's a little bit of a interesting kind of a early first foray, or a mini deep dive into the kind of global history of where archaeology fits, or at least this particular area of archaeology, the archaeology that is associated with Middle Eastern, African, and Asian history, where a lot of that from the European side of this archaeological study, why places like Egypt and Egyptology and places like India, why they and the antiquities of India and China, why a lot of that stuff becomes so interesting and important in Europe. It is intertwined with both the ancient study of these regions, the medieval study of these regions, where European powers in the 1100s want to now transfer a lot of the knowledge of the Middle East and Asia for the sake of European infrastructure and science and medicine. But it's also, later on, it becomes intertwined with the study of the cultures and ecosystems of the region for the sake of both the kind of life of the mind, but then also for the sake of administration and the project of modernizing colonized regions to integrate them into a European-centered colonial economy. So it's all extremely interesting. And in the bonus episode, I'll do a little bit of a deep dive into the life of a couple of these famous European archaeologists. And in later episodes, we'll continue region by region, looking at a couple of interesting examples of what the archaeologists found. And let me add, as we finish up here, that of course, it's not the 10 or even 11, 12, 1300s. It's not the medieval or the early modern colonial era world where the idea of digging into the ground to look for historical things was invented. Of course, you have all of these republics and empires, like the Venetian Republic. They are back in the 11, 1200s. They are, in fact, all, of course, building their own archives of their own histories as they form a kind of national history or regional or urban history that draws on a lot of the meanings and values that they associate with their own ancient pasts. And so this is where they also are kind of uncovering and looking for ancient objects in their own regions, whether it's Rome, ancient Rome, and the ancient Roman church, looking for and discovering relics and objects associated with ancient figures like Julius Caesar, or ancient, more sacred figures, saintly figures, and putting those objects in treasuries of churches, looking for ancient coins and understanding their own history. So, you know, the discovery and search of ancient coins has, of course, a very ancient history when it comes to looking for things of value and really reselling those things, or looking for things that are of maybe historical meaning that might be important for, like, the church. And so all of that stuff has a kind of archaeological dimension that predates the colonial era and that predates the era of the medieval world, when people were studying a lot of the cultures of the world for the sake of advancing their own medicine and infrastructure and whatnot. And the last thing I'll say is that, of course, in the 1900s, after the end of the colonial era, both countries that were on the colonized side of this history and some of the countries that were on the colonizing side of the history, that in both cases, they, in continuity with places like ancient Rome, they, of course, see the continuing value of understanding ancient history for the sake of ecological advancements and for the sake of understanding how the economy worked historically in order to extract lessons for the modern world, lessons for the future. In the same way that people who are inventing new technologies often study natural biological systems. I think it's called biomimicry. You know, looking at how hummingbirds fly in order to build different kinds of new flight technologies. So in the same way, you do see European powers and Middle Eastern, Asian, African powers seeing the continued value in understanding and extracting a lot of this history underneath the ground, understanding how the Ice Age happened, the Bronze Age, understanding the impact of climate change historically and today, building new sophisticated data for tracking earthquakes across the past 2,000 years. A lot of this stuff is, of course, moves far beyond any particular narrow colonial administrative project. And this is where you see, both for the sake of heritage and for the sake of learning and advancement, that a lot of countries still today support and pursue the development of the archaeological sciences as a central part of history and the social sciences and humanities. All right, so let's leave it at that.